Accession number 13939, Reel 1.
This is an interview with Master Airloadmaster Ian Guttridge at RAF Lynham, recorded by Rodney Giesler on March the 17th, 1994.
Say again, please.
30th of May, 1952.
And how did you come to join the Royal Air Force?
I left school at age 18 with 7 O levels, but no A levels. I was having difficulty finding a job simply because the people I were in competition with were usually better qualified than me. Excuse me. So I decided to try and join Her Majesty's Forces. Originally, I went to the Army Careers Information Office, but I wasn't heavy enough. So the reason I went to the Army first is because my uncle has been in the Army all his life, and he seemed to have a good time and get around the world a fair bit. Having been told by the Army I wasn't suitable, really, I went next door to the RAF Careers Information Office, and a week later I started training. I started my training on the 1st of September 1970. Went 6 weeks at Swinderby, 9 weeks at Hereford Trade Training, and then my first unit was RAF Catterick, which was the regiment depot in those days. I stayed at Catterick for 2 years. Was starting to get disillusioned with the promotion prospects in my own particular trade at that time. I was a supplier. I then got posted to Stanbridge, near Leighton Buzzard in Bedfordshire. Again, I spoke to my sergeant, and the promotion prospects were pretty much nil. I was at that stage, I'd only signed for 9 years, and I would be lucky to get to corporal before I was due to leave. So I read an advert in the RAF News for the flying sergeant. So although it was, yeah.
Excuse me, what?
Oh,
sorry.
It's okay. Better get to. Oh yes. So I saw the advert and made some inquiries, and discovered that as well as air electronics operators, they also had flight engineers and air loadmasters. Well, ALM being the closest to the job that I was already doing, I applied for that. Unfortunately, I was accepted first time. I had an interview with the station commander. I waited approximately 6 weeks, and then I was told I would be offered a place at Biggin Hill on the selection course. I went up to Biggin Hill, managed to get through all that, and I started my aircrew training in November 1973.
I didn't ask you what you trained on.
We had an air experience flight, which was 4.5 hours on a varsity at Finningley, but so I'd already done 6 weeks at Topcliffe at that stage, which was the basically teaching you how to be a senior NCO. I then did 6 weeks at Finningley on the basic air loadmasters course, with a gap of 6 weeks between, because the whole school moved from Topcliffe down to Finningley. Having completed Finningley, I did 9 weeks at Abingdon, learning how to be a dispatcher. 6 weeks. And then I went to Odeon to be a helicopter crewman, where I was promptly told to forget everything that I'd learnt to that stage, because it was all fixed wing orientated. I spent approximately a year at Odeon. I then went to Cyprus for 2.5 years on Whirlwinds. I came back from Cyprus to do 4 years on Pumas, back to Odeon. Having finished my tour on Pumas, I moved around the airfield to start on Chinooks. I did 3 years with 7 Squadron, although it was, when I joined it originally, it was called the UK Chinook Squadron, because we didn't have a number. I got seconded to 18 Squadron when the Falklands War blew up. came back from the Falklands the first time. Eventually went to Germany with 18 Squadron, and then I left there in 1988 and came to Hercules. So that's my sort of my service history.
And the Hercules is in fact the first fixed wing aircraft you served, aren't it?
Yes, I've been on Hercs now for about 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me roughly what a loadmaster does, what his function is, what his responsibilities are?
It's my responsibility primarily to the aircraft captain for the safe loading, lashing, restraining of freight, proper documentation, in-flight catering. Well, that sounds not a great deal. In actual fact, it does entail quite a lot. Certainly on the fixed-wing fleet, most of the loadmaster's job is complete before you actually get airborne. Because it's involved with the loading of the aeroplane and the associated trim calculations and the associated documentation that goes with it. Once you get airborne, most of your work is frequent checks on the freight and various hydraulic systems and feeding the crew and looking after the passengers if you're carrying passengers, of course.
When you're doing airdrops, I suppose that's when you're really keyed up.
That's pretty hectic, and it's all laid down, cut and dried. Certain things happen or certain things don't happen. There's very little room for error, and it's the most enjoyable side.
You were talking about when you're doing an airdrop, is it dropping a load suddenly, getting rid of the whole load of the aircraft?
Yes, it's it depends a great deal on the load. I mean, small loads, obviously, it doesn't take a great deal of effort. I suppose the most spectacular is a double MSP, which is two medium stress platforms in one aeroplane. Weighing up to 14,000 pounds each, and from the time the extraction sequence is initiated to the aircraft being empty is 11 seconds. So that amount of weight disappearing in that short a time is quite spectacular.
You get a sudden nose down trim then, do you?
No, not really, because the pilot's expecting it. When the co-pilot presses the button which releases the extractor chute, then the captain is expecting quite a large trim change, and he's prepared for it. So the actual attitude of the aircraft changes very little. If he wasn't expecting it, then yes, it would be quite a nose up pitch as the platforms go over the ramp. But because he's prepared, the trim change in the aeroplane is not really significant. Well, it certainly doesn't seem that way to me down the back. It's probably more noticeable on the flight deck, but I don't often get to see that end of things because I'm busy down the back.
So how many are there of you? There's you and a couple of assistants, or what?
It depends on the type of load. It varies between myself and two dispatchers. For the bigger loads, you would have me as the sort of supervisor with a full team of four dispatchers. For an MSP, there's only one person down the back, and that's me, and I'm sort of stood well out of the way.
When you were on helicopters, what sort of operations were you usually on? I mean, if for instance you're just dropping infantry or something, I suppose that's your responsibility as well.
The bread and butter work really was training the army how to work with helicopters, getting what we called M-planing and D-planing drills, and marshalling and hooking up of underslung loads. That was basically what we did. The helicopter fleet is totally in support of the army. In fact, there's been several not recommendations. Several suggestions put forward by the army over the years that they really ought to have control of all the helicopters. In some ways it would make sense, but For the people who joined up in blue uniforms suddenly to change to khaki, I don't think they'd be too happy. But I suppose financially and operationally it would make more sense for the army to have control. The biggest problem is they haven't got the technical expertise to maintain them, not to the same level that the Air Force has.
Because they do have their own helicopters, don't
they? Yeah, they have. They've got Scouts and Gazelles and Lynx, but all the larger helicopters, particularly Chinooks, are operated and maintained by the Air Force because we've got the expertise. I'm not saying that people couldn't be trained, or just to change of uniform, but it would involve quite a large number of people, because it's not just the operating crews, it's the ground crew as well. They would all need to change, because, as I say, the army, although they have Remy engineers who do their maintenance, they're not by any means as skilled as the Air Force engineers.
Presumably when you were based at Odeon, you were mainly operating in the UK, were you? Salisbury Plain, places like that?
Yes, most of the military training areas, like Stamford, Otterburn, Salisbury Plain. It was very rare that we actually did anything for the Air Force. 99% of it was in support of the Army. We used to do occasional tasks, like particularly in Northern Ireland, rescuing other helicopters, and in Belize particularly, sometimes we were once asked to try and rescue a Harrier that had managed to get itself stuck on one of the keys, but it proved an abortive attempt in the end, because although we could lift the engine and most of the ancillary equipment, we couldn't bring the main plane, because it's got a nasty habit of getting airborne underneath the helicopter, even if the aerofoil is spoiled. No, just by the fact that the airflow over the wing tends to make it fly.
Well, when you're travelling, well.
Yeah, even at relatively slow speeds. In the end, they decided to fly the damn thing out. They sent a very senior engineering officer out from England to Belize, and he decided that it was fit to fly one trip only for the 3-minute flight from Key Chapel back to Belize camp. I think the junior pilot got a job for that.
So you've been around quite a lot in your career then?
Yes, I've probably travelled more since I joined the Herc Fleet in terms of worldwide travel. The places I've been when I was on helicopters, Belize several times, Northern Ireland very frequently, particularly when I was on Pumas, I was in Norway every year, and then on Chinooks, mostly in England, and several tours to the Falklands.
Can you tell me a bit about your experiences down in the Falklands now?
Well, I was sat at home on in the early part of May 1982, and my crewman leader rang me up at home and said, you and two of your colleagues have been seconded to 18 Squadron because they're going to the Falklands. We'd obviously been following the lead up to the task force actually departing on the news, but not expecting to go. And when he rang me up and he said, you're leaving on the 6th of May by VC-10, you've seconded to 18 Squadron, and I don't know when you're coming back. Probably
that was down to Ascension Island, was it?
Yes, yeah. Probably several months. So we flew by VC-10 on the 6th of May to Ascension Island. We left Ascension Island, I think it was about 5 days later, on the merchant vessel Norland, which I'd already been on several times across the North Sea to visit relatives in Germany. And we sailed from Ascension to the Falklands, 6 weeks.
That's what it took?
That was my total length of time at sea. It was actually, it took us 2 weeks to sail down with the rest of the task force. Although we were somewhat distanced from the what we used to call the grey funnel line, the Royal Naval ships. And we were in company with, among others, the Atlantic Conveyor, which of course, as most people know, was hit by an Exocet missile. Well, we were... took us 2 weeks to get down to the Falklands, and while we're in San Carlos Water, or Bomb Alley as it became affectionately known, the Argentinians were mounting daily airstrikes, and for a short while the Chinook crews were on ship's defence. We set up four machine gun posts with GPMGs on, I think it was B deck.
GPMGs being what?
A general purpose machine gun. And each gun crew consisted of a regiment corporal who was the controller, a regiment gunner who actually fired the weapon, and a loadmaster as the belt feeder, because it's belt ammunition. And one of the guns, the gun that I was on one particular occasion, was later credited with shooting down an A4. Anyway, Norland finished discharging its cargo, and then quite naturally the crew, who were still the complete civilian complement, they'd all volunteered to a man and two women, quite rightly said, well look, we've got rid of all our cargo now, we would like to go home. Well, certainly, which involved moving all the helicopter crews to obviously another vessel. So we were told that we would go across to HMS Fearless, which wasn't a very popular decision, because as we pointed out to our commanding officer, he said, we're all going, been transshipped to HMS Fearless. And we said, well, we don't want to seem, you know, ungrateful or intransigent, sir, but it's come to our attention that the Argies are only having a go at the grey funnel line. They've left the civvy ships alone so far, and you want to put us on one. He said, well, that's where you're going, you know, it's not my decision, no, that's come from further up the chain. So we all moved across to HMS Fearless, and we were on board for I think it was 2 days. On the second day, we were either in what we called a mess deck, which was where up to 10 of us slept, or we were allowed out to go and eat, and we were allowed out in the evenings. But during the day, when the air raids were going on, we were sort of confined to the mess deck, mainly because we didn't know how to anything about the ship or how it operated, and it was better for us to be out of the way of the crew, who could then go about their duties. And while we were in there, one of the regiment lads came in and said, Atlantic Conveyor's been hit and it's gone down, which was a bit of a blow, because they had four Chinooks on, which is what we were waiting for, to actually go to work. And we said, no, you know, stop messing about. It was Carl Pollock. He said, come on, Carl, you're pulling our leg. He said, no, it'll be on the ship's tonneau in a minute. I bet you watch. And sure enough, the ship's navigator came on and said, I'm sorry to have to inform you all, but Atlantic Conveyor's taken an Exocet missile, which was meant for HMS Hermes. Hermes is safe, but unfortunately, Atlantic Conveyor is burning, and badly. And they lost three of the four Chinooks, 9 Wessex helicopters. Fortunately, the Harriers had already left and gone to Hermes. But it wasn't just the aircraft, it was what was in the holds. I mean, Atlantic Conveyor was carrying, I mean, I couldn't give you a complete list, but tentage for 4,000 people, for starters. The complete Chinook spares, backup, toolkits, the whole lot. So effectively, when Bravo November XV-718 was already airborne on an air test, fortunately at the time, when she left, whatever she was carrying was all that she had in terms of the only tools that the guys had were what they had in the pockets. One lad had a screwdriver, somebody else had a spanner, and that was it, because everything else was destroyed as the conveyor became a burnt out wreck. So having the following day, they said, well, look, we're going to put you ashore for the day, and then at the end of the day we'll make a decision, and because Fearless was then going to move. Being a command assault ship, it was obviously going to be used for moving personnel around. It also had its own complement of, I think it was either one or two Seeking helicopters, which also were going to be used. And we came back to Fearless at the end of a day, having been spent ashore, watching the RGs coming over in their A4s and superintendards, and they then told us that you're going to have to leave the ship. What we're going to do is put you on a small ferry and send you back out to sea until the next batch of Chinooks arrives, which will probably be about 3 weeks' time. So there we were. We left the safety of, relative safety of San Carlos Water in a 4,900-ton, flat-bottomed, lorries-only, roll-on-roll-off ferry. And we spent the next 3 weeks sailing in a gigantic triangle between a point approximately 300 miles northeast of the Falklands, and we sailed, I can't remember the exact distances, but it was about 300 miles east, 300 miles northwest, 300 miles southeast, and back to the original point. And we did that for 3 weeks in some quite heavy seas at times.
Which a flat bottom didn't help.
Well, it wasn't designed for the South Atlantic. It was designed to do, I think it went from Southampton to one of the channel ports, and it only ever carried lorries. It never carried cars, so it had little accommodation. I remember several of the other lads were seasick. I seem to be blessed with reasonably good sea legs. One lad in particular, one of the co-pilots, went to his bunk on the first day, and he didn't come out for a week. He was really desperately ill at one stage, but he managed to sort himself out and overcome it eventually. I remember one night, as it was getting closer to the next batch of Chinooks arriving, one came from it was Bravo Papa, I can't remember the number. It came across from Contender Byzant, which is the airplane, the container ship that they'd requisitioned to bring the Chinooks down. And the thing about Europic Ferry, which was the vessel we were on, it had a very long, flat afterdeck, more than large enough to take a Chinook. And Bravo Papa came ashore, or came to us, late one afternoon. In fairly good weather, and the crew were to stay overnight and then fly onto the Falklands the following morning. And we lashed this large helicopter to the deck with 8 10,000-pound chains, two from each leg, each undercarriage leg. And that night we went through a force 9 gale. captain of the ship wanted us to the load masters were helping us station keeping watch by being up on the bridge for 2 hours at a time and helping the ship's crew to keep station and keeping a visual watch for, you know, the other vessels that we were with, which in a force 9 gale and throwing down with the rain is virtually impossible anyway because you can't see further than your nose end. And the captain wanted us to go down every 15 minutes and check the lashings on this on the Chinook, and we said, well, have you got any safety lines out? And he said no. I said, well, we're not going, because the last thing I want any of us to do is to be washed overboard. And I think we were all a little surprised to discover the following morning, which was a beautifully clear day, that Bravo Papa was actually still strapped to the back end of the ship. Three of the chains had broken. Fortunately, they were on three separate legs. I suspect if two of the chains had broken on any one leg, then it would have gone. Obviously, it was somewhat wet inside and out, but it started up okay, and they took off and went to went ashore. And a few days later, several of us were taken across to the Contender Bezant to bring, I can't remember which one it was now, another Chinook ashore to the Falklands, which we did. Of course, by this time the war was over, the battles had been fought, we were in charge, and we stayed in, we set up a Chinook operating base at Port San Carlos. Got to know the locals extremely well. In fact, they made us very, very welcome. I think when we finally left to go to Kelly's Garden at San Carlos, I think they were quite sorry to see us go, despite the mess we'd made of their village green. But all in all, it was, at the time, I never stopped to consider what we were doing or why we were doing it. It just, you know, we just got on with it. I left the Falklands having been there 3.5 months, and when I got home, I can remember all the family were together, and my uncle, who was obviously being a military man himself, he was, I suppose, concerned, but I suspect he also, you know, wanted to know what I thought of the whole thing. And I remember thinking at the time, I got quite upset. I started to cry, and I just remember thinking, was it worth it? 298 British military people killed, most of them young men, for what? Thousands and thousands of sheep and thousands of acres of peat bogs. And at the end, a group of Falkland Islanders, well, the whole lot of them, particularly the residents of Stanley, who really couldn't wait to get rid of us. They were happy for us to come and kick the Argies out, because they didn't want the Argies, you know. I mean, we were the better of two evils, if you like, but when it was all over, they wanted us to leave. I think what they failed to realise was that life for them was never ever going to be the same again. It was never going to be the same from the minute the Argies set foot on the island, whether the Argies had stayed or whether, as it turned out, we kicked them off and they remained British. But I think what they wanted to do was just get back to the way things were before it all started. And of course, as we all know, that is never ever possible after a war, conflict, whatever you want to call it.